There's the big board, the 20 electoral votes from the state of Pennsylvania. We just got new metrics in.
Right now, a historic moment. We can now project the winner of the presidential race.
The inauguration of a president celebrates a peaceful transition of power engineered by the American voters.
The president-elect of the United States of America, Donald Trump.
Donald J. Trump is the president of the United States elect.
This is a political upset of huge, huge magnitude.
The country still divided.
This is your life now. This is our election now. This is us. This is our country. It's real.
Hi and welcome, listeners of the 45th podcast. Glad to be back. Rabia here, and I'm joined this week. It's just me and Sarah this week. Hi, Sarah. How are you?
Hey, I'm good. How are you?
I'm very well. So this week, me and Sarah are both really excited. We have a special guest on, and when I brought his name up, Sarah jumped at the opportunity, and I'm so excited to have this guest on this week to talk about issues that are, I know, on everybody's minds. They dominate the news. Well, let me first introduce our guest. His name is Seamus Hughes, and he's a deputy director on the program on extremism at George Washington University. First of all, hello, Seamus.
Hello.
Thank you for joining us. I'm going to tell our listeners a little bit about your work. So right now, Seamus is the deputy director at GW on this program. But before that, and when I met Seamus, he previously worked at the National Counterterror Center. He did some really interesting things there. He was a lead staffer on U.S. government efforts to implement something called CVE, which is Countering Violent Extremism Strategy. At NCTC, he did all kinds of interesting things, like he led engagements with Muslim American communities all across the country. He actually provided counsel to civic leaders who were in the media spotlight after high-profile terror-related incidents. He met with families of people who joined terrorist organizations. And one of the most important things I think he did there, at least important to me, was he created a groundbreaking intervention program that helped to steer people away from violence without using law enforcement interventions. And then before National Counterterror Center, Seamus was the senior counterterrorism advisor for the U.S. Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee. Now, I can go on and on. There's a lot he's done here, but folks can take a look at the GW website and see your full bio, but I want to get right into what you're doing right now, Seamus, at GW. Can you tell us a little bit about this program?
Sure. The program on extremism launched 2 years ago, actually, this week. And the idea was to look at extremism in the U.S. context. Far right, far left, jihadist, you name it. We kind of look at it. And look at it in terms of just the facts, ma'am. So we look through about 10,000 pages of legal documents for all ISIS-related activity in the U.S. We have a team of folks that look at the online environment. So, you know, everyone who talks about how great ISIS is, we collect against it and say, are they more likely to talk about the Assad atrocities, or are they more likely to talk about the NBA finals? And what does kind of an ISIS American recruit look like online? And we pull through that. We also have a team of folks that look at other issues, whether it's, like I said, far right and far left extremism. We bring out a lot of outside experts to kind of talk about these issues. Our main goal in this is just look at the data and tell a story that way. Don't kind of politicize it. Don't look at it any other way. Just, you know, what's the facts look like?
It sounds like you do a lot of data, like gathering. You do all these research. You go through the legal stuff. You're following them on social media. And then what do you do with that information? I mean, are you creating policy reports, recommendations? Are you creating like an open source like databases for folks? What do you actually do with the material then?
Yeah, we're pretty transparent on it. So we put all of the court records we can on our website. So I think we have about 10,000 pages on there right now.
Wow.
And every month we do an updated snapshot of ISIS in America, which is essentially all of the cases of material support to terrorism in the U.S. And right now we're at 125 U.S. persons have been arrested for terrorism charges as it relates to ISIS. And then we kind of dive into the numbers. And the numbers tell an interesting story. So, you know, the first kind of takeaway is that when we're talking about at least ISIS in America, we're talking about homegrown terrorism, right? Mm-hmm. These guys are born and raised here. It's not kind of a threat from outside. It's kind of in. And that kind of should inform the policy discussion on these type of things, right? And so it brings up the whole host of questions about the travel ban and all of these different dynamics. We also found that the vast majority of the individuals are male. They tend to be younger. So the average age of an ISIS recruit in America is 27. But in one third of the cases, they're 21 years or younger. So the trend line's going younger and younger in these dynamics. And the average prison sentence for an individual is about 13 years. So we have a whole host of policy questions there, right? How do you kind of scope the problem? And then on the back end, if the average prison sentence is 13 years, at some point we're going to have a number of individuals who are released from jail, who have served their time. And so what do we do with these individuals? You know, there's going to be a level of recidivism in the process, because
sure.
You know, terrorism is a form of crime, right? And trying to figure that all out. But the main goal of the program is to kind of inform the policy and public debate on these issues, and to take these very esoteric documents and put them in a way that makes sense for folks that want to just get a quick snapshot of what's going on.
So, Seamus, like you said, I was looking at the newest project that you guys have called ISIS in America, From Retweets to Raqqa. And, you know, in light of what you just said about the average age of these people in the U.S. who happen to be U.S. citizens and permanent residents is 27, and 89% of them are males. I saw some really interesting things in this. It looks like the 125 people that were charged since 2014 is the largest amount of people, with 56 individual arrests in 2015. It's the largest amount since 9/11. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, I mean, it is unprecedented, but I should note that it's unprecedented, but not compared to other countries. So the U.S. has been very lucky in the last 15 years of not really having that large of a homegrown terrorism problem, relatively.
Yeah.
The FBI would say they're kind of stretched thin, but if we're looking at about 125 folks in the U.S. context, U.K. is looking at 800, 900 north numbers of individuals who've traveled to Syria and Iraq. So putting that all in context, I think that's important.
Well, I think you hit on a very important word, which is context, because I think a lot of our news feeds are filled up with stuff that is sort of, you know, it causes a lot of alarm, but we don't realize that our country is huge. Not that I'm justifying any of this existing in the first place, but, you know, people have to look at it relatively. But I did also notice that a lot of the stuff here said that, I mean, I think I read in the report that 40% of the ISIS recruits or the people associated with ISIS here in the U.S. are converts to the religion of Islam.
So it marries up actually with the general American Muslim population of converts, depending on the Pew data you look at. And so you have individuals that are steeped in the faith that, you know, were Hafiz and kind of went to Islamic schools all their lives. And then you have folks that essentially convert to ISIS, not Islam, and everything in between that. You know, we have seen examples of individuals that were very naive. So I'll give you a good one, a quick one. So this time last summer, we were looking at a young woman online in the Midwest who had a questions about her faith, recent convert. And so she asked her questions on Twitter, and an ISIS recruiter realized she was naive and answered the questions about religion in a very innocuous way, didn't kind of opine on it. Once he built a level of trust with her, he then slowly introduced the ISIS narrative into the conversation. So there's a grooming process online. And in many ways, you're looking at these individuals who are trying to find some justification of what they're seeing in current events and what they're seeing in the news, and they're finding that kind of assurances online as opposed to the offline space.
You know that everybody who's got a tattoo has a great story that goes with it. And I heard a great tattoo story the other day from the company that I get my socks from, Bombas. See, Bombas started when two guys, Randy and Dave, heard that socks were the number one requested clothing item in homeless shelters. So for every pair of socks that Bombas sells, they donate a pair to those in need, which is pretty cool. Now, Dave promised Randy he'd get a Bombas logo tattoo when they donated 1 million pairs of socks. He thought it would take 10 years, but it only took 2.5. And now Dave has a Bombas tattoo and a great story to tell about it. Now, I don't have any tattoos, but I can tell you this, that Bombas are the most comfortable socks that I've ever put on my feet. They don't have an annoying toe seam. There's no seam on them. No falling down your leg. There's added arch support. They have solved every annoying sock problem imaginable. So, for the best socks in the history of feet, which is a long history, visit bombas.com/45th today, and you'll get an additional 20% off your first purchase. And remember, for every purchase, they will donate a pair of socks. So go to Bombas, bombas.com/45th for 20% off. That's bombas.com/45th and enjoy the best socks your feet will ever meet. So let me ask you, the 125 folks who are, that you have tracked in this report or so far, these are people who have actually been arrested and convicted, right?
Yeah, so the individuals who have been charged, the vast majority have been arrested. But some have been charged in abstentia. So if they're in Syria and they get charged, but the vast majority are arrested.
So it's not necessarily a reflection of like folks basically who either are under the radar or they haven't moved to the level of being charged with anything, which number one, do you have any sense of numbers on that? And then number two, what triggers an arrest in these situations? You mentioned something about people wanting to travel. Well, I mean, if somebody just wants to travel to Syria, so what?
Yeah, I think the U.S. government would say that does matter. So if you put it in the context, the FBI director, the former FBI director, has said there was 1,000 active investigations in all 50 states. And so you neck down the number even more, and you have 250 Americans have attempted or have traveled to Syria and Iraq, and then even smaller than that, 125 have been arrested or charged with terrorism-related activities.
I actually think that's a good thing in the case of the U.S., because if you look at the Manchester attack, apparently the young man who had, blown himself up in the stadium after the Ariana Grande concert actually had traveled to Libya, whether it was for the summer with his family. And so there were warning signs of him being in a hot conflict zone where he was exposed to ISIS ideology. And I think us being more strict about it leads me to my question of what is the U.S. doing right that perhaps, and I'm not putting any blame on London, but perhaps, you know, compared to what's going wrong in London, how are we different?
Yeah, well, I think we're different for a variety of reasons. I mean, one is just the ease of travel. It's harder to get to Syria and Iraq from the U.S. than it is in Europe. The other thing I think is very important is we haven't seen, with some notable exceptions, in-person recruitment happening at a large scale. Meaning that if you're in Molenbeek or in parts of London or the U.K., you can find an individual who can kind of help guide you through the process. But we haven't seen kind of radical Salafist organizations pop up. You know, the Sharia for UK is a good example. We haven't seen that in the US context. And so that kind of diminishes the numbers. We talk a lot about the online environment, and I think that's very important, but the offline connections really do matter. And in the US context, we haven't seen that crop up. The other reason I think we've seen lower numbers is that the US has much broader laws and statutes in order to go after an individual who's radicalized into violence, meaning that we have something called the material support to terrorism charge, which is a very, very broad statute, right or wrong. And so it allows for the U.S. government, the FBI, to arrest an individual who drives to the airport with a ticket to Turkey to cross the border. In Europe, you don't have that kind of statute. Mm. You also don't have undercover agents, informants, agent provocateurs, however you want to describe that. It's kind of more of a U.S. phenomenon. So we don't have these things bubble up to the point where they become a larger issue, I guess.
So Seamus, I have more questions about the way we charge versus what happens in Europe, and then also the issue of, you know, in what context can people actually return from these situations? But I'll get to that a little bit later. I want to take a little bit of a step back. You guys focus specifically on ISIS, and is why ISIS to the exclusion of the many, many thousands of other violent extremist groups, number one. And the second question I have is, you said the word earlier, radicalized. And, you know, that's been a really complicated question of how do you, like, what are the factors that lead to radicalization? What does radicalization mean? Are there, like, you know, we know there's no like one path that leads people, but as you've been studying, you said just the facts. Can you tell us a little bit about what are some of the things you found in common? But let's talk a little bit about why only ISIS, and then tell us what it means to be radicalized, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, so we've looked at ISIS because there's other organizations that do very good work on far right extremism, you know, Southern Poverty Law Center, ADL, places like that. You know, we do have a number of reports on far right extremism. In fact, last month we released a report on sovereign citizens, which is a pretty large phenomenon in the U.S. And if you talk to any local cop, they're more worried about sovereign citizens than they are ISIS.
Well, I actually meant, okay, that's good to know, and I do want to talk about that, but I actually meant ISIS to the exclusion of other foreign terrorist groups.
Ah, gotcha. Yeah. So this is actually very interesting. So ISIS is the biggest game in town when it comes to American jihadist recruits, but we have seen a number of cases of individuals who decided to not join ISIS and go to Al-Qaeda or Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. A great example of that is an individual out of California named Adam Shafi. So Shafi was interested in ISIS, but then he saw all of the beheading videos and he said, you know, they're too violent for me. And so he decided he wanted to join al-Nusra. So you kind of have a discerning interest, right? And so sometimes you see that. But for the most part, you're talking about between the jihadist groups for the Americans, it's a difference without a distinction.
Wow, so you have picky terrorists.
Yeah, I mean, you do have picky terrorists. But for the most part, you're talking about individuals go to ISIS because that's the biggest game in town. That's more likely to be able to find people on there than they are, say, an Al-Qaeda recruit. But they also have mixed motivations. So think of, you know, 1 year ago, we had the horrible attack in Orlando. And Omar Mateen was interested in al-Nusra and ISIS at the same time and Al-Qaeda. And so he just, you know, he went with ISIS because of a variety of different factors, but it wasn't kind of the exclusion of others.
So can you talk a little bit about the idea of radicalization and how this happens?
Yeah, so radicalization is this catch-all phrase that can be the cause of and solution to all the world's problems, right? And so the idea is someone takes on radical beliefs and then moves over to violence, I guess, is radicalization of violence. And so there's a hodgepodge of reasons why people do that. And there's not a linear path, right?
Don't you think, Seamus, it has something to do with the age that they're at and, you know, the opportunities that they have or not? And, you know, they're not juvenile, but they're increasingly growing. They're younger, the data is showing. So maybe it is sort of like a, you know, something that teenagers and young kids would be engaging in. Instead of having their backyard as the place that they gang up, it's kind of like now a much bigger platform or global kind of gathering.
It's clearly a countercultural kind of movement on this. And there's an emotional appeal, right? So if you look at the earlier cases, 2014, 2015, there clearly was, you know, they saw the Assad atrocities, the barrel bombs, the breadlines that you and I see on the nightly news, and that was kind of a draw for wanting to join. The later cases were much more interested in the perceived religious obligation. So the announcement of the so-called caliphate was a driver for these folks to go join. So there's a mixture of it. What I would say, what's interesting about this is if you look at successful, for lack of a better word, attacks in Europe, you do see that actually the trend lines for the attackers is much older than individuals that are arrested or traveled to Syria and Iraq. And so if you're older, you're more likely to commit an attack. If you're younger, you're more likely to travel. Again, noting that the numbers are so small that you kind of shake it either way, depending on it. But there clearly is an emotional thing. You know, I've been interviewing a lot of formers, for lack of a better word. So these are individuals who joined terrorist organizations, you know, served time in jail or, you know, moved on. And I think a lot of this has to do with age too, right? You know, after 10 years, they look back at their lives and say, you know, I didn't want to do this anymore. And you have kids and you have a life. And, you know, the example of a guy I interviewed a few months ago, he got a nice job up in the Northeast and has a lovely family. And he says, you know, that wasn't for me anymore. And so it depends on the individual.
Wow.
Clearly, I think the ages matter.
You just talked about, I think I've watched some of your clips because, you know, it's fascinating what you've accomplished in, you know, in the last few years in this arena. But I think you mentioned that there's different levels of engagement or different types of engagement online, and it has a lot to do with those areas of where ISIS is just involved in grooming people, which I think you already mentioned. And then there's also the logistical stuff of how they use Twitter, and then the fact that they'll engage in egging people on. So there's like different ways of getting through to these weaker you know, people who are kind of looking at their lives and going, I'm not really happy with where I am, or I can't get a job, or I'm not happy with how people treat me. But, you know, these kinds of different approaches, it's kind of effective online. So I just wanted to know, you know, ask you if you could expand on how, what kind of things they use online, not so much the tools, but actually the tactics.
Yeah, I think, and the way you categorize it, it's right. So the first one is that grooming. So we talked about that young woman from the Midwest, and you do see a number of people being groomed online. The second way is acting as a travel agent. So a good case example of that is a kid named, and I use the word kid, but a guy in his 20s, Muhammad Khan, who drives to the airport, O'Hare Airport, with his 17-year-old and 6-year-old brother and sister, and they're going to go join ISIS. And when Muhammad Khan gets arrested, they go through his pockets and his phone, and he has numbers of people to call when he gets to Syria and Iraq. You know, how does a guy from, you know, outside of Chicago get numbers of an ISIS facilitators? Through his contacts he made on Twitter. So they act as travel agents. And then I think the last part is probably the more pressing issue is what the former FBI director termed the devil on the shoulder. So these are individuals that are being egged on by ISIS to do what they can where they are. My colleague Alex Hitchens and I looked at this phenomenon of what we call ISIS virtual entrepreneurs. So about a year and a half ago, you had a team of about 6 to 8 English-speaking ISIS guys and gals in Raqqa who are actively reaching out to Americans to commit attacks. So Junaid Hussein is a kind of a famous British guy who was in Raqqa, and he was reaching out to a kid in Ohio and giving him the Amazon link to buy a knife, and then the address of a local military officer in Ohio to kill. And so kind of getting them all the way to the point, but not kind of being there physically. And so it's a hybrid between the old and the new ways. So the old days you spend 2 years in a training camp, you hang out with 20 other guys, and then you come over here. And then at some point we had kind of lone actors or lone wolf attacks where you had individuals kind of inspired by it, not really having any real connections. Now we're in this hybrid moment where they do have connections with folks in Syria and in Iraq who are encouraging them to attack, but they've never met them in person. You know, it's similar to kind of how you develop friends online, right? I have a number of individuals or friends that I've met on Twitter and other places like that who I've never met in the physical world, but I have a pretty good relationship with them because I probably talk to them every day or things like that, right? And that's a similar dynamic happening with an ISIS recruit. In fact, we've seen kind of a very systematic way of how they groom folks. So there's a case out of Ohio where an individual, Al-Sudani in Raqqa, was directing a young man to commit an attack. And he's giving, as part of the kind of the wiretaps, you see that he's giving another ISIS guy a step-by-step direction on how to deal with this guy. So he's saying, you know, make sure you don't bring up this, because if you bring up this, he's going to close up. Make sure you encourage him to do that, because this is really his pressure point. So it's a very systematic approach to try to recruit folks.
So, you know, it's clear that ISIS is very sophisticated, especially vis-a-vis other terrorist organizations in their use of social media and the internet in general. You know, there's so much kind of media they put out. They use Instagram, they've got online magazines, so many different ways they use the virtual space to groom and recruit and direct and all these things. I have two questions related to that. One is, how do the authorities track this stuff? Like, you know, you mentioned those siblings who were traveling to the airport with the tickets to overseas. How do the feds know that? How do they track this stuff? And then number two, if so much of this is online, why can't we shut it down?
Yeah, the question I get all the time, which is, in the case of the young man from Chicago, Muhammad Khan, he left a note for his mother saying, you know, I love you and I'm leaving to join ISIS. So, you know, she called the FBI as soon as possible. And so we have what we call the bystander effect in these cases. So the vast majority of the 125 have been arrested. A family member, a loved one, saw something that was concerning, but didn't really know what to do with it. And so there, that dynamic plays out more and more. But there also is the online connections allow the FBI to open up an assessment or a full investigation on an individual. And so in many ways, you're dealing with folks that are fervent in their beliefs to begin with. So they're very vocal about it and seeing that play out. In terms of why can't we take this stuff down? if you had asked me 2 years ago what the platform of choice was for an ISIS recruit in the West, I was going to tell you Twitter. It is not that anymore.
Isn't it something called Telegram now?
It's Telegram. So, okay, so the good old days of about 10 years ago, every would-be terrorist was on about a dozen password-protected forums. And we could collect against it. It was easy kind of to – they were all kind of pushed into this kind of margins of the internet. And then the advent of social media, if the average age is 27, of course they're on Twitter. Of course they're on these different platforms. They move over to Twitter, and they're able to recruit at a higher number. Twitter has gotten kind of hammered by the media and the Hill, Capitol Hill, to take down content. So they've been much more aggressive on removal. And now they've largely moved to Telegram, which is an end-to-end encryption. Think of like a group chat. And so you don't necessarily have to – it's not necessarily closed forums. Most of them aren't closed forums. But you do have to know what you're looking for to find it.
You know, what I found interesting is I looked into Telegram and I found three things really interesting. One is it was created by two Russians. The other thing was it has an ability to self-destruct. So whatever they put up there, they can actually time the destruction of the material. And it's also the secret part of the actual app itself is very, very heavily encrypted and cannot be tapped into, unlike things like WhatsApp.
Yeah, absolutely. And so think of social media companies on a spectrum. So on one side of the spectrum, you have Facebook, which is very proactive on removing content and very proactive on pushing alternative or positive messaging. And then Twitter somewhere in between. And then Telegram is kind of a very hands-off approach to this. And if given the option, social media companies would be libertarian in their views, right? They would want to say, you know, leave the content up and let the best, you know, the marketplace of ideas take care of this problem. But you do see kind of an evolution in thinking as the companies grow, as they get, you know, more lobbyists, more kill calls, things like that, they become more sophisticated in the way they take down content. Telegram, you're talking about a team of about 8 folks. And so not only are they taking down ISIS propaganda, they're also looking at child pornography and things like that. And so, and the founder has to move every 2 weeks so he doesn't get killed by Russian services. So
wow.
There's a whole host of questions of why Telegram is it, but it clearly is the platform of choice for these folks.
Like in terms of the tools that they use and the technology, I mean, is there a way for us to kind of separate what ISIS uses to actually organize itself with existing bases or sleeper cells versus what it does or what it uses to actually get new recruits?
I would say that Twitter was kind of the platform to recruit, and Telegram was the platform, and Kick was the platform to plan attacks. And so what you usually saw happening a few years ago was someone would talk about how great ISIS was, and then they'd move over to Kick to have one-on-one communications with folks to talk about attacks. And so that's usually the way they operate in these type of things.
So can I ask you, what is the general trend you are seeing as you're tracking these cases? Are you and how does that trend relate to what's happening in Europe and also what's happening in conflict zones?
Yeah, so in the U.S. context, we've had we're down to zero or a trickle of individuals that are trying to travel to Syria and Iraq. And there's two reasons for that. One is ISIS has been very explicit about saying to their followers, do not come here anymore. It's too hard to travel. And
but what happened to creating the utopia?
The caliphate.
Right, the caliphate and bring your family and friends.
Now they're okay with a virtual caliphate, I guess. And so you actually do see that the messaging changing and saying, you know, do what you can where you are. And so the real question becomes, you know, are we going to see the radicalization pool, for lack of a better word, shrink, meaning that you're less likely to get the fence sitters that you had in the past? And are you going to see the mobilization pool increase, meaning individuals that are mobilized to action, to violence? And I think we may see an uptick in the short term of attacks because the individuals that are left are true believers through and through, and they need a kind of a release of the valve. And so, you know, I think that's one of the reasons why we've seen recent attacks. There's also been kind of an uptick and a concerted effort by ISIS to encourage their followers to attack.
Well, they have been losing land, and they will eventually at some point, because they're being driven out of places. So is this going to be mostly an online thing? Because I know Theresa May was like, we need to have a robust kind of online, you know, anti-terror kind of campaigns around the world. But is that always going to combat this kind of thinking? And I was going to ask you more about transnational crime as an issue now that we have the internet and people can easily organize wherever they are, and the actual presence of ISIS. I mean, how can you differentiate? Because a lot of these attacks, you know, the guys that engage in them have criminal backgrounds already. So all this is just a reason for them to continue down that path of crime, but just using ISIS as an excuse.
Yeah, and let's unpack those two questions. So the first one about Theresa May saying that, you know, we need to have kind of a more robust campaign against ISIS online. I'm not a huge believer in a don't do drugs campaign when it comes to ISIS, meaning that you don't need to have a broad-based 30-second clip on YouTube because you're not likely going to be able to hit your target audience for that. You're more likely to have success if you have one-on-one interventions or one-on-one online communications. I'll give you an example. So last year I was talking to a foreign fighter, a British guy, who was in Fallujah. And we were going back and forth on Twitter for quite a while, over the course of 3 or 4 months. And he would kind of chide me and send me a bunch of stuff, and I would chide him back. We'd have a good old time, right? And so, you know, I knew what his touch points were after talking to him for 3 months. And so on Easter, I knew he was a convert. And on Easter, I said, have you reached out to your mom, let her know you're alive? I know you're not, you know, a practicing Christian anymore, but, you know, she would like to know that you're still alive. And he shut down the communication for a few days. So I know I knew I hit a touch point there. And so that's labor intensive to try to do that kind of counter messaging or communication with folks. I also know what the material support to terrorism clause is. So I know I'm not going to send him stuff. And I also know what the local FBI field office is, so I'm not going to end up on a watch list. But all of these things take time and effort in a way that a 30-second clip on YouTube doesn't, but it makes politicians feel very good about themselves.
And can I just say, given the anecdote you just shared, people don't try this at home. I don't think it's good to, we just don't want to encourage like individual citizens to be saying, oh, okay, you know, I can try to, because I personally, I think that's like a really dangerous territory for folks who are not experts and not trained in how to deal with these people to try and engage.
You're absolutely right. In fact, we had to go through a number of hoops in order to do that. And I wouldn't encourage anyone to do it that didn't have kind of the full understanding of what they're doing. In fact, you know, when I used to do community engagement on these things, and Robbie, you and I have dealt with this issue before, which is, you know, you have a number of individuals or imams who want to engage with folks online, but are worried about being secondaried or ended up in an investigation. And that's a fair concern.
Absolutely.
And so, yes, I would be very hesitant for anyone else to kind of do this. I do it knowing full well the risks involved in it and the occasional threats that I get from folks, you know, who say, right, you know, I'm going to go after you and your family.
One of the difficulties of this issue, I mean, we had so many discussions around it, was for the very, very, very few folks, and we're going to talk about CVE and the controversy in the Muslim community on this entire issue to begin with, but for the very few folks in the Muslim community who did want to do some of this work, they could not be provided guarantees by law enforcement that, listen, as you talk, if you are engaged with somebody online or you're trying to intervene and they go do something, we cannot guarantee that you couldn't be charged with somehow being involved. There was just no guarantee, no legal protection for them, which made it really hard for them to do that kind of work and really scary for them to do that work. So,
and you also, you come up against the material support to terrorism clause. You know, I was talking to an American who wanted to join ISIS, and she asked me to send her a bunch of court records so she could kind of plan her attack or plan her travel to Syria and Iraq. Right. I clearly didn't do that. But if I did do that, if it was kind of an innocuous thing of here's a public record, I may bump against material support to terrorism clause. And so we need, if we're going to ask community partners to do this type of online engagement, it's behooving us to at least provide them some level of guidance of what they should do when it comes to that. There's also another host of other questions, which is, you know, civil liability, right? So if an individual, if you try to intervene with an individual to try to get them off the path, lack of a better word, path to radicalization, and they commit an attack, are you civilly liable for that? Are you going to be called as a witness at a terrorism trial if the individual gets arrested? And all of these things, these can of worms that are very actually low-hanging policy questions that could be solved if you throw a bunch of lawyers $100 in a room and take away their food. But we haven't done that.
So, Seamus, a question for you, going back to your days of engaging with communities on the ground and being at mosques and talking with people. As an outsider, a person that doesn't belong to the faith, I want you, if you can, to describe to us what your you know, what is the Muslim community to you and what were those mosques like? Because I think that there's a, you know, given the protests that just happened recently against quote-unquote Sharia law, whatever that is to whoever, you know, I want people to understand, you know, what they should or shouldn't be afraid of, and that as an outsider and a person who's getting into really the core of these sensitive issues with communities and mosques and imams, and, you know, how tough was it for you to kind of figure out the community? And also, when you're working on something like this, how do you manage with a mosque community to maintain the First Amendment rights of people and yet go in there and kind of get all this information for government use in the end?
Yeah, there's a lot of issues to look at here. So my first kind of experience with community engagement was a number of years ago, and I was in Minneapolis, and there had been a number of, about 20 folks who tried to join Al-Shabaab, a terrorist organization in Somalia. And when I landed there, you know, there's a foot of snow on the ground, of course, because it's Minneapolis. And I get a phone call from a guy, and he says, you know, Seamus, my name is such and such, and I am the representative for the Somali community here. And if you want to talk to anyone, you go through me. And so you have to go through the gatekeepers first. And if you can't go through the gatekeepers, you go around the gatekeepers. And I usually like to go around the gatekeepers. But I, the way I did community engagement was one, I'd like to be requested to come in. So after three girls in Denver jumped on a plane to go join ISIS, and they were turned around because their father called every phone number in the Denver phone book till he got an FBI agent. And when I got the call from Imam there and said, you know, Seamus, three of my girls did a horrible thing. Can you come talk to my congregation about another three girls not doing that? And so that's a very delicate thing. And so when I went to Denver, actually, this is a good story. When I went to Denver, there's about 300 people in the room. Everyone's very tense. The girls had just returned. And the organizer of it stood up and goes, you know, ladies and gentlemen, this is Seamus Hughes. He's from the intelligence community. He's going to talk to you.
Oh, right. Wow.
So I was already on my back foot. At
that. All eyes on you.
Yeah. Godspeed. And so I realized very early on in my time as a community engager that numbers and facts are less important than stories, meaning that, yeah, it's very interesting that the average age is 27 and 45% are interested in traveling to Syria and Iraq. And yeah. But everyone's eyes glaze over on that. What's more interesting, and the way that you pull in audiences, is to talk about stories. So, you know, my name is Seamus Hughes. Let me tell you the story of Burhan Hassan. Burhan Hassan was 3 years old when he left Somalia. He spent 4 years in a Kenyan refugee camp. He came to Minneapolis and spent his formative years there. He was thinking about being a lawyer. On election day of 2008, he disappeared. His mother called every phone number she could, realized that he had gotten on a plane and had joined Al-Shabaab. Al-Shabaab had told him that he was going to build a better Somalia. When he got over there, he realized it was a pack of lies. He had doubts. He called his uncle. His family found out he was killed by looking at Somali news websites. My name is Seamus Hughes, and I want to save the next Burhan Hassan. Right? That's a different story than numbers. Yeah. And I was earnest about it, too, because I do want to save the men and women that are trying to join this. Now, there's going to be individuals who deserve the full tonnage of the federal government's weight. You know, they grab an AK-47 in Raqqa. Okay, yeah, you get 30 years or worse. But there also is the Burhan Hassans of the world, the 17-year-old kid who people saw that it was something concerning and didn't act and didn't know how to act. And I think it's incumbent on government and communities to provide an alternative to that, because I don't ever want to be in a room, and I've done this too many times, I don't ever want to be a room of crying mothers asking me to save their kids who are now in Somalia or Iraq or Syria. I don't want to do it, right? It shouldn't be on us to do that work. And so I found it as a calling to be able to try to prevent individuals from doing this. And I also found it important to put it in a human context. It may not be your kid, but it could be your neighbor's kid. Understanding the numbers are small, but it could be your neighbor's kid. And let's figure out a way to save these people from themselves.
So when you talk to communities and you tell them these stories, what has the response been generally?
pretty good, actually. I mean, the real issue is always getting in the door. When you get in the door and you don't say something bigoted and you don't sound like exactly what they would expect from a government official, I think that that's important. And there is something powerful of, you know, Seamus Hughes, an Irish Catholic from PG County, a white guy, standing up and saying there's no typical profile of an ISIS recruit, and that, you know, just because your skin color does not mean that you should be profiled. There's something powerful with a government official standing up and saying that. And I think the reaction is relatively good on that. My concern with these type of engagements, though, is I'm not sure I'm hitting my target audience, right? I know I'm talking to a room full of 300 people. I'm pretty sure I did a pretty good job, but I don't really know. And I also don't know if those 300 people are the folks I need to talk to, which is why I'm more inclined to be drawn to one-on-one interventions of, I got a man or woman I'm concerned about, and let's figure out a way to bring them back into society.
Well, you know, as you know, I mean, when I first got to know you, I was launching, and then I ran the program for about 4 years, something called the Safe Nation Collaborative, which did law enforcement training, but also did community trainings on these issues. And what I found, you know, as I spoke to mosques about these issues, again, giving them facts and then giving them stories, was, number one, a real lack of information. Like, people were kind of horrified that this was happening. And when I say people, I mean, like, you know, most of these meetings wound up being like parents and stuff, right? So they have no idea that their kids can so easily be connected. I think they don't realize that how much their kid can get done on a smartphone, right?
Yeah.
And how these people from overseas can so easily connect to their children. They have no idea like what the potential is in the online space, and they don't know what's happening. The honest truth is, in our community, we never talk about these stories. We just don't. Because we do consider them outliers, and they are outliers, fair enough. But even then, you know, there has just never been a conversation on these stories. Like, you just don't hear them. And
well, I also think, Robbie, there's an element of, and I'm not making excuses for it, but, you know, it's really tough when immigrant parents come here.
Right.
You know, oftentimes there are two parents working in the household, and the children, for them to be getting attention and, you know, trying to get acculturated and turning to their cell phones and people that are texting them every day, making them feel special and giving them that attention, you know, they're not aware that their kids can be tapped into that way.
There's a real lack of awareness. But the other thing I noticed is that there's a real disconnect from kind of Muslim leadership or activists online. And I want to go on to that talk, which is about like the whole controversy around CVE. And Seamus, you know it as well as I know it. So why don't you tell our listeners like kind of what the issue is? Like, doesn't it make sense? Wouldn't anybody want to counter violent extremism? Why don't people want to do that?
Yeah, I think there's the whole host of issues. So when countering violent extremism was announced by the Obama administration, and the Bush administration had tried a number of different ways, but the Obama administration really went all in on this idea of countering violent extremism. The problem was the administration didn't define what that meant, what CVE or countering violent extremism meant. In lieu of that vacuum, it was defined
Didn't they take that term from the UK?
Yeah, so there's a debate on whether this was kind of modeled after the Prevent program in the UK or whether it was kind of a standalone. If it was modeled against the UK, it wasn't modeled very well, meaning that, you know, the UK, they actually had funding behind it and tried some interesting novel things. In the US context, it was me and three of my friends doing the best we could. And so that was kind of the full effect on it. You know, civil rights and civil liberties organizations will say that you're trying to criminalize speech, and you're trying to, unless someone has committed an act of violence or committed an illegal act, the government shouldn't be anywhere near that. And that's a fair concern, except for when you're sitting across the table from a mother who's asking you for help. And if you're providing them nothing, then that's on you. And we as a community, both in government and outside of government, have provided literally nothing to families that are grappling with this. And our religious leaders are not necessarily interested in this. CVE was doomed to fail to begin with because there's been no funding behind it. It had been defined by outside groups as such, and there was no real chance for it to survive. Now you have a new administration, which, you know, try to walk into a mosque of 300 people and talk about terrorism now. I'm not sure it goes well as it might have before. And so you're already uphill to begin with.
You know, I tend to think of the anti-CVE folks, and you know, there really there was actually even, and I don't know if I think it still exists. There's an actual anti-CVE movement in some parts of the activist Muslim community, and you know, I completely understand their concerns, and I think some of them are legitimate concerns.
Those annoy me because that's like washing your hands clean of the issue, just because of the terminology. Because I think if change is going to happen, it has to happen from the community.
Well, here's the thing, though. I mean, like, when you really parse out a lot of their allegations, I compare them to the anti-Sharia movements, which is protesting something that doesn't exist, because a lot of the allegations are simply inaccurate. Many of the allegations I hear over and over as somebody who worked in CVE in a very broad sense was that a CVE is just a mechanism for the government to survey Muslim communities together. And I said, you know, no, that existed. That's called CT. I'm like, that's that mechanism has always existed, right? Like for the law enforcement. And CVE is supposed to be a non-law enforcement, like, you know, like ideally, right? Like it's supposed to be a way to like prevent people from getting to that point. And we don't have any good, we have no good answers even after all these years. Largely, I think, because there are some activists who have been so, and they are the ones who really control the spaces in our like major institutions, right? Major
Muslim institutions. I've been struggling with that, Rabia, because I see a lot of them going out in marches and stuff and kind of focusing more on how they've been denied, you know, the subject of discrimination when, you know, all that energy could be spent on weeding out what really needs to be weeded out. And, you know, this is a country of laws, and relatively speaking, you can use that and get somewhere with it. But, you know, this growing problem, which has data behind it, by the way, so it's very unlike the Sharia issue, is sometimes it really annoys me. I'm like, can we be more introspective and grab the bull by the horns and kind of address this issue and look at parenting and all things like that that need to be happening at a core level in communities versus sitting there and whining about, you know, or crying about, you know, somebody gave me a look here and there.
You are going to get hurt on that.
Someone needs to say it. I'm tired of it.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, you're right about the data, but Seamus, here's my question for you is like what we, when it comes to CVE, when it comes to preventing something, the data is actually, we don't have good data on what actually works. Like how do you, because it's hard to gather data on like, you know, non-events happening. So number one, how do you address that? And then number two, what is your advice to a community that has no idea what's happening? They're not equipped to deal with it. They don't want their kids being, to me, I don't think it's that much different than like a sexual predator grooming your child and then trying to like lure them out. Like how should, what kind of community response would you like to see?
Yeah, let's take the first part, the conversation prior to. I mean, I used to get frustrated with the anti-CVE crowd because they'd have more staff than I did.
six of them, right, versus four of you.
I hope that issue's been solved now with this program.
Not so much. I think the issue with CVE was, or anti-CVE was, you know, you had a number of individuals who came upon it honestly and were concerned about it. And then another set of individuals that are intellectually dishonest about it. And the intellectual dishonesty always bothered me. And they'd be willing to take funding, but just not do it publicly, or they would attack another group for taking funding while they raise money off of it. So there was a whole host of kind of issues there. In the meantime, you still had 125 folks who got charged with terrorism charges and 125 families who had to deal with that dynamic. And so it frustrated the hell out of me every time on this. In the ideal world, you're looking at a community-led program. And the question about measurements is a good one, but one that we can solve. So I don't think you can measure 300 people in a room engagement. You can measure whether you closed a FBI investigation through a non-law enforcement mean, meaning that if you brought in a religious leader, a mental health professional, an educator, a whole host of things, and an individual is no longer thinking about joining ISIS and you close the FBI file on that, that's a measure of effectiveness. And I think you can go back to Congress and say, I need money for that because of it. But we haven't done that in any systematic way whatsoever. And so I would get away from the broad-based programming and I'd focus on the one-on-one interventions. And that's largely where our European partners have moved to. You know, there's a lot of attacks on the UK's CV program, the PREVENT program, rightly and wrongly. But for the most part, they're not doing broad-based engagement anymore. They're largely focusing on the channel program, which is a one-on-one engagement with its faults, but still an attempt at it. In Germany, it's all one-on-one. And it's not just jihadist inspired. You know, they have Exit Germany, they have Exit Sweden that looks at far right or white supremacist movements or neo-Nazi movements there. And so I would focus my programming on this individualized approach to prevention. But the thing is, this is all manageable, right? So we're not – the joy of being in the U.S. government on this type of stuff and the joy of being in the U.S. on this is that our numbers are not orders of magnitude larger than anybody else's, meaning that we actually can wrap our hands around this.
Well, why does the world make it look like – or why does this country make it look like there's – you know, this is big, rabid threat, and some elections were won on that basis too.
Yeah, I think that there's a whole host of reasons. I mean, national security has always been politicized. It's just the nature of national security. You know, I used to like to have it stop at the water's edge, but that's me being idealistic. I think there's the fact that ISIS had a very large territory, the fact that it was able to recruit 40,000 foreign fighters, it's not something we should kind of ignore. And I think that's one of the reasons why it got as much play as it did. And the other reason is, you know, nobody had kind of taken a step back and said, what are we looking at?
You know, one of the things you you mentioned very briefly, nativist white national extremism in Europe that some folks are working on, and then your program also does some work around it. Can you talk about like the relative domestic threats, even though, or how are these even things to compare? Like, you know, people want to know, like, you know, well, I mean, ISIS is what kind of dominates the news, and the conflicts are so heavily around ISIS and what's happening. But like relative to let's say the threat from sovereign citizen groups, I mean, what are we talking about in the U.S.?
Yeah, it's not necessarily my full level of expertise on it, but I would say this, right? I always get very frustrated when I see stories that say far-right extremism is more deadly than ISIS-inspired, or ISIS-inspired is more deadly than far-right extremism, as if someone's death is less relevant depending on who killed them. And as if you shouldn't be worried about the Nadal Hassans of the world as much as you are the Dylan Roofs of the world. And I think we can kind of tackle these two problems head-on, and we don't do that in a way that makes any manageable sense in the U.S. context.
Well, I'm going to push back a little bit on that, because I think the concern on that is not so much, at least my perspective on that, is not about, you know, like at the end of the day, obviously violence is violence and people are going to get hurt, and it's not about who the victim is or who the purpose, but also like how our resources are focused.
Yeah, right? No, I think that is absolutely fair. I find that most folks, when they make those arguments in the public sphere, are not doing it in order to have that conversation.
Yeah.
And so there is a good question to be had about how much resources the FBI and DHS is putting towards far right, far left extremism in the U.S. And I think you could argue that it's minuscule compared to the nature of the threat. In fact, you know, DHS has disbanded a number of times their far right extremism analyst group. Now they're back up again, but it's just a few folks there. FBI has a pretty solid analyst crew and a pretty solid undercover organization or undercover network for white supremacists. But again, it pales in comparison to jihadist-inspired terrorism. And there's a whole host of things. There's also a larger question of tools and abilities, right? In the international terrorism space, you can use a FISA. You can use a whole host of different
legal tools.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That you're not going to be able to use for domestic terrorism. Because we don't have a domestic terrorism list, you know. So the reason you're able to open a FISA on somebody like Al-Shabaab is because Al-Shabaab is listed as a foreign terrorist organization by the State Department. It's not like the Aryan Nation is going to be listed as a domestic terrorism organization by the State Department.
This flows very beautifully into my next point that I wanted to kind of grill you on. But about 5 years ago, I was writing a paper at Georgetown for my graduate program, and I was able to get an interview with one of the handful of, you know, federal judges that looks into, you know, gives FISA permits out. And she, in the course of my interview with her, mentioned two things. One was that she was constantly sidelined from her actual work of giving out the FISAs by nonstop kind of alarms of lone wolf attacks around the country. So a lot of the times things are sitting in the pipeline, she's having to give out the FISA things, but then she's stuck with having to deal with imminent threats that are happening all over the country immediately. So the other point she brought up was that, you know, ISIS itself, even if it wanes, there's an issue of lone wolf acts throughout the U.S., and that's going to continue because people just have the capability to go out and do those kinds of things. So her thing was, it might be ISIS today, but then these are lone wolf things will happen under some other ideology at some other point anyway.
No, I think that's fair. I won't hold it against you that it was Georgetown, not George Washington.
Okay.
Seamus, you know what? You'll be happy to know my daughter just got into GW's cybersecurity program. So.
Thank you. Yay. I appreciate my salary. I think that's a fair question in terms of FISA concerns. And you know, it's interesting. This week, actually, we'll release a new report that looks at every attack in Europe and North America in the last 3 years since the announcement of the caliphate. And so the largest number of attacks was in France, and 17 successful, again, for lack of a better word, successful attacks. Followed by, if you had to guess, what would you say?
UK?
Nope.
Wow.
17 successful attacks in France, 16 successful attacks in the U.S.
Oh, really?
It's counterintuitive, right? If you look at the news, you say, oh, man, Europe is on fire.
Right.
Attacks. The U.S., we've actually...
16? I'm like, were there really that many?
Right.
Yeah.
But you're talking about small attacks, right? So you're talking about knife stabbings in Minneapolis or Minnesota. You're talking about an individual who drives his car in Ohio State. All of those kind of small level things. The thing is, actually, I think we're becoming used to it, for lack of a better word, like similar to school shootings now.
Yeah.
That it's less of a news story than I think it would have been in the past. You know, San Bernardino was a two-week story. Orlando was a week and a half or so. And my concern with lone wolf attacks and things like that is you are going to see you're probably going to see an uptick in attacks in the next couple months, both in Europe and in North America, because of the territorial losses, but also because ISIS has been calling for attacks, and they have been for the last 3 years, actually.
One of your colleagues said to me a long time ago, Seamus, that, you know, the thing about this, you do this work, but you can't prevent every single, it's going to continue. Like it's impossible to prevent like lone actors from doing harm with things as, you know, they can get easy access to like a car or a knife. There's just no way to completely prevent it. And that's one of the tragedies about this. But I want to thank you so much for joining us for this hour. And I wanted to know, is there a way for folks to contact you or follow you or connect with you?
Sure. Yeah. So we have our website. If you type in, Program on Extremism in Google, it'll pop right up. All our court records are available online. We're pretty active on Twitter. It's GWUPOE, or my own Twitter, which is Seamus Hughes, SEAMUSHUGHES. And they can reach out anytime. Look, the reason we set up the program was to be a resource to folks. So if you have a question about terrorism, if you'd like to just talk about what's going on, you're not going to bother me. Shoot me an email. It's available on our website. And I always try to respond to anybody who has questions about this, because it's incumbent on us as a public organization to provide information to the public.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. All right, guys. Thank you so much. We're going to wrap up here. And Seamus, it's a pleasure. And thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for tuning in again this week, and we really hope to keep coming to you weekly, but in order to do that, we do need your support. So please consider becoming a patron of the 45th Podcast. To do that, just go to our Patreon page. It's www.patreon.com/45thpod. Again, that's patreon.com/45thpod, and Patreon is spelled P-A-T-R-E-O-N. A big thank you, of course, to everybody who helps make this show possible, beginning with our fantastic sponsors. Thank you for supporting us. Thank you to Ray Gaines for our audio production, our kick-ass producer, Mithal Thelhan. Thank you. You are the best. We have been produced by Long Arc Digital Media. And you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Our handle is @45thpod. Please do check out our website at www.45thpod.com. And you can reach us and leave us your listener messages, which we love to check into, at 202-670-8345. Again, it's 202-670-8345. Thanks again. See you guys next week. I'm sitting with the booth in my lap. Like, I'm on a bed. I've gotten
that
out of the closet.
That thing is heavy.
Not bad, but here's the thing, the inside of the booth, because it's filled with foam, I guess my cat, it's full of cat hair. They sleep in it. It's disgusting. Anyway.
All right, I'm recording.
All right, here we go.
Hi and welcome, listeners of Undisclosed. We're back this week with me, Rania, and
hey,
Sarah.
Hold on. It's
we're not Undisclosed.
I'm so sorry. This is what happens when you have two podcasts.